carrying on this series that we've been doing through John's Gospel. It's worth saying, and we've tried every iteration of service sheets and trying to be safe with this. At the moment, you can get a list of the sermon points if you go to the website. If that's useful to you, you can print it off in advance, or you can have it on your phone as you listen. It might be a help. And the passage is definitely going to be a help, because we're going to look at that in detail together now. The question I wanted us to begin with is, can we really know for sure? Our current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, in his days beforehand when he was a journalist, he once wrote in his column in the Daily Telegraph, "My faith is a little bit like Magic FM in the Chilterns, in that the signal comes and goes," he said. And it's a very vivid description of what is, I think, quite a common experience, that of spiritual uncertainty. Some days people feel God's very, you know, perfectly obvious. Some days, other days, they wake up and they wonder if it's all just wishful thinking. If you were with us last week, we're in this chapter, John chapter 20. We're looking at the resurrection appearances of Jesus. And we saw one of the first bits of evidence for Jesus' resurrection. And we talked about eyewitnesses. We talked about the empty tomb, the appearances of Jesus. We talked about the transformation it produced in those first witnesses. And all of that is very important for us as Christians. But there is an approach to the Christian faith which acts as if evidence and deduction is the whole story. And strangely, I think that approach can leave us thinking, can we really know for sure? I had a friend who was looking into the faith, and I remember him saying he'd looked at the evidence for the resurrection, and he said, "I get that it would take more faith to believe in any alternative explanation of what happened, but is that really it? Is that where I'm left? I just have to take a plunge based on," as he said, "the balance of probabilities." And if you're a believer, I wonder how you would respond to that question. This chapter is all about enabling us to believe, to have certainty. And the chapter ends, I'm going to give a kind of overview of the whole chapter, not just our section, but the chapter ends with the famous summary verse, chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, that says, "Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, but these are written so that you may believe." And if you go through the chapter, it's got lots of emphasis in the first half, at least, on what the disciples saw. So Peter saw the linen cloths, John saw and believed, "We have seen the Lord, we have seen the Lord." And then the second half of the chapter ends with Jesus telling Thomas, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed," i.e. blessed are you if you now believe as a result of what the apostles tell us. And so if I had to summarize the whole chapter, it would be this: the apostles believe by seeing, so that we can believe not by seeing, but by hearing or reading. And I think that is pretty clearly the message of the whole chapter. That's the macro point. And if under that heading, this passage that we're looking at today doesn't really fit, because today's passage is about this woman, Mary, and how she sees Jesus. And that's what we're expecting. Lots of people seeing, see. In fact, she's actually the first human being to see the risen Jesus in verse 14. But here's the shock: she completely misses it. She doesn't even recognize him. She thinks he's the gardener. It's actually, I think if you're trying to construct evidence for people seeing clearly and then passing it on, this is a bit of an embarrassing text, because she sees and doesn't recognize him. It doesn't fit with this "they saw, then we hear" kind of paradigm that's going on. There's something else going on in these verses. And also in the next chapter, chapter 21, verse 14, Jesus appears to the disciples. They have a barbecue on the beach, and we're told it's the third time Jesus reveals himself to the disciples. And if you think about it, that makes the first two times when Jesus appears to the whole group in verse 19, and then again 8 days later in verse 26. So John, in his counting scheme, he doesn't even count this episode with Mary as one of the major evidences. I guess perhaps because it's only to one person and judicial evidence in the Bible requires two or three witnesses. So the verses we're looking at today are here for a different reason than the other bits of the chapter. They're not just another chunk of evidence leading up to the conclusion in verse 30. They're doing something else. And I want us to consider, what are these verses here for? And the answer, I think, is that these verses are here to teach us a different perspective on faith and spiritual certainty, which we might otherwise miss. And as we're going to see, they're also here to help us grasp what Jesus' resurrection means for us today. So let's look at these verses now. And the first point we're going to see from them is... Jesus reveals himself to those who are seeking him. So let's look at verse 11 again that John read. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. And as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb. Poor Mary, the others have gone, Peter and John, and she's here. She feels utterly alone. But we discover she's not as alone as she thinks. Look at verse 12. And she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head and one at the feet. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They've taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." So despite the fact that she saw him die, for her, Jesus is still her Lord. Her loyalty is still fixed on him. Verse 14, having said this, she turned round and saw Jesus standing. But she did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, and this is repeating the question of the angels, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And then he adds this extra question, "Whom are you seeking?" And supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him and I will take him away." And immediately we see what a different experience Mary has from John's experience that we looked at last week. So do you remember John got no angelic messengers? John got no appearance of Jesus at the tomb. And yet in verse 8, we saw last week, he saw the linen grave clothes and he believed. And here's Mary, and she's so different. She's caught up in her grief to such an extent. She's so transfixed on where the body is, that she just can't see what is staring her in the face. Literally, Jesus right there in front of her and she can't see him. And we're thinking, what is going on here? And I want us just to step back a bit and read this in the context of the whole gospel and see that this should be very unsettling for us, this passage. When Jesus asked the question in verse 15, "Whom are you seeking?" And that question actually is like a bookend. It echoes the first words that Jesus speaks in this gospel. In chapter 1, 38, Jesus asks Andrew and probably John, "What are you seeking?" And it's a question Jesus asks on two other occasions, back in chapter 18 in Gethsemane. Whom do you seek? Whom do you seek? Seeking Jesus is one of the big themes of this gospel. A quarter of all the times this seeking word comes up in the New Testament, it's in John's gospel. But not all seeking for Jesus is good seeking. For example, in chapter 6, verse 24, the crowds who witnessed Jesus feeding the 5,000, we're told that they seek Jesus. But Jesus says they're seeking him for all the wrong reasons, that they just want their stomachs filled. And so actually they end up missing out on Jesus and his offer of the bread of life. The authorities in chapter 7, they seek Jesus, but we discover they're seeking Jesus to arrest him and kill him. And Jesus tells them, you will seek me, and you will not find me. Where I am, you cannot come. So we discover seeking is good, but there's a right and a wrong way to seek for Jesus. And Jesus' question to Mary means we're immediately asking, well, which one is Mary doing? What kind of a seeker is she? There's this repeated dynamic in this gospel, that Jesus is described as light. His light shines out for all to see. And of course, where people seek Jesus rightly, where they respond to the light they have been given, they receive more light, more certainty. And there's an upward spiral of belief and knowledge of Jesus. And then there's the other way. Those who try and squeeze Jesus into their mold, I want this kind of Jesus, or they just reject his light, they end up in darkness. They end up not recognizing what is right there in front of them. And they go on this downwards trajectory. And all of this is in the background as we see Mary does not recognize Jesus in verse 14. And we're thinking, well, what's going on? What kind of a seeker is Mary? Jesus warned us right at the beginning of this gospel that many people would not recognize Jesus. There's a famous verse, chapter 1, verse 10. He, Jesus, was in the world, though the world was made through him. The world did not recognize him. And we're worried. Is Mary another person, like so many in this gospel, who has Jesus right there in front of her and she just misses out? She fails to recognize him. All of that in the background. It's a very unsettling moment. And with all of that in our minds, we get to this beautiful moment now in verse 16. And Jesus said to her, Mary. And she turned and said to him in Aramaic, Rabboni, which means teacher. And then by the next verse, verse 17, she's clinging on to Jesus and she doesn't want to let him go. And what we're seeing in this verse is that Jesus reveals himself to those who seek him. This isn't like John in verse 8, where John made a deduction on the basis of the evidence he saw. This is a different experience. This is Jesus personally breaking in to Mary's world and lifting her blindness and blowing away the fog and showing himself to her with absolute certainty in a way that she can't avoid. And so much certainty, actually, that by verse 18, any doubts and confusion are just banished. And she's the first human being to declare, I have seen the Lord. And the reason this is so important for us to underline is that, especially if we're looking in on the faith from the outside, I think we worry, don't we? We worry that there's this unbridgeable chasm of time. It all seems so distant, so long ago. Am I really expected to make such a radical change in my life based on some accounts that were written down hundreds of years ago? And yet the wonderful reality is that the same Jesus who walked out of that tomb 2,000 years ago, he's alive. He's alive today. And he is in the business today of revealing himself personally to individuals, giving us spiritual certainty, just like Mary receives here. Now, of course, Jesus doesn't do that in a way that bypasses the testimony of the apostles, so that, you know, what we've got here in our hands, our Bibles are just redundant. We just wait until he does something magical. No, he reveals himself through his word in the Bible. And that has been the testimony of billions of people, Christians across the world, down the ages, that as we hear the Bible taught day by day, week by week, there is a supernatural experience. We encounter God himself speaking to us. And the objective realities recorded in the Bible are then subjectively confirmed to us. Now, if you're not yet a believer, this might be a relief. And it might explain something strange that you have experienced about believers. Mark Ashton, he was the vicar of the church. Andrew and I and others in the congregation, I think Dave Butler and Laura Sanderson and others, used to go to. He gets quoted by us a lot because he's had a big impact. But he said that when he was a non-Christian as a student, he never lost an argument against a Christian. And if you met him, he's dead now, but that was very easy to believe. He was a formidable intellect and a formidable arguer. But what he found so frustrating as an unbeliever was that even though he always thought he had the upper hand, he'd outwit them, he'd have a better turn of phrase, The Christians Mark knew never shifted their ground one centimetre. And Mark said he found it absolutely infuriating. And yet at the same time, he came to realise that even though they weren't necessarily great arguers, and in his view, they weren't particularly impressive thinkers, the Christians he knew, he could see very obviously that they had something which he didn't. They had something precious, something immovable in their lives. They had relationship with God. And it was that that persuaded him to take Jesus seriously himself. Because Jesus reveals himself personally to individuals. And actually, this discovery is very liberating. It's very liberating if we've got friends whom we'd love it if they shared our faith. Because think about it, if someone coming to faith was all about me having the evidence at my fingertips and then me prosecuting a very effective argument and being able to answer every question thrown at me, then obviously we'd all feel utterly ill-equipped, we'd be discouraged most of the time. But thankfully, because ultimately it's Jesus, he's the one who reveals himself to people, he's the one who calls people to follow him, then all we need to do is just pray and point people to him. I was thinking about this in John's Gospel. Who's the most effective evangelist in John's Gospel? We've been doing John's Gospel for quite a long time now, and I would argue it's probably the Samaritan woman in chapter 4. And what does she do? Well, she just says, well, check out this guy. I've just met him. Could this be the Christ? And her whole town come and they investigate, and they all end up believing in Jesus. It's this wonderful revival. And all we need to do, I guess, is just pray and say, look, I don't know the answer to all your questions, but I can tell you this, I have found Jesus to be utterly amazing and persuasive, and I think you will too. That's all this woman did, and it was very effective. And when Jesus calls Mary's name here, in that beautiful moment, Mary, and suddenly the fog blows away. It's a deliberate link in this gospel to what Jesus said earlier in chapter 10. This was chapter 10, verse 3. The sheep hear the shepherd's voice, Jesus said, and he calls his own sheep by name. Do you hear the echo? Mary, and leads them out. It's such a beautiful verse. If we're trusting in Jesus today, whatever steps there have been along the way, and every one of us, our story is different. For some of us, we've never known a time when we haven't believed. Others of us came to faith later in life. But what all the stories have in common is this. The Good Shepherd, the Lord Jesus, called us by name. And he said, Erin, come to me. He said, Prem, come to me. Jack, come to me. And at the time, it felt like we were the ones doing the running. We were doing the investigating. We went to the course. We were weighing it all up. And Jesus says, behind all of that, let me tell you what was really going on. I was calling your name, your name. I wanted you. And that is the reason why each of us belongs to Jesus today, if we've had that experience. Personally, I find this so encouraging. Yes, God so loved the world. Yes, God has a macro plan for all of creation, for his church down the ages. And yet Jesus also has a plan for little me and little you. He's our shepherd. He loves us. He's laid down his life for us. And he has revealed himself personally to each of us. He's called us by name, just like with Mary here. And that's a great comfort for us. So we began, didn't we, with that question, can we really know for sure? And these verses show us that coming to faith is not just, as it was for John, an objective investigation of the evidence, but also how God accompanies that with a subjective, personal confirmation of the truth. Jesus reveals himself to those who seek him. And wonderfully, that personal encounter with God is only the beginning, because as we're going to see next, when we come to Jesus, he welcomes us into relationship. the relationship that we were made for. I guess that the two most profound, the two most intimate of human relationships, I guess, are the relationship between marriage partners and the relationship between a parent and a child. And both of these human relationships exist to try and give us a glimpse, to try and give us a snapshot of the relationship, the one relationship each of us was made for, the deepest possible relationship a human being can have. And both of these images of our relationship with God have already been hinted at, they've been trailed earlier in this gospel. And now that Jesus is raised here in chapter 20, we see these threads finally coming together and being held out to us. That Jesus is the divine son who invites us into his family, and that Jesus is also the divine bridegroom who fulfills our longings. We're going to hit both of those now. So first, Jesus is the divine son who invites us into his family. So listening to what Mary says next in verse 17, Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and say to them," here it is, "I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Right back at the beginning of this gospel, we saw in chapter 1, we were told to all who believed, who received him, who believed in his name, this is Jesus, Jesus gave the right to become, here it is, children of God. Children of God. It might seem, you know, a small thing. What, you know, we say, well, of course, you know, why wouldn't I be God's child? But actually, as we read through John's gospel, we've had the veil pulled back to see that the most fundamental thing there is in all existence, the thing which has always existed, even before there were stars in the sky, is the love relationship between God the Father and God the Son. And with that background, Jesus steps out of the tomb and he says this, "Look, something has changed in the fabric of reality. Something is new. Yes, I know I've called God Father for all eternity. That's not new. But from now on, because of my death for you, because of my resurrection, that privilege is yours as well. My Father and your Father, my God and your God." I know there's, you know, in this Zoom room, there's going to be all kinds of imperfect experiences of fatherhood. And for some, this teaching about God being a father, we may find that hard to receive and digest. But for a human being to know the Almighty Creator as our perfect loving Father is a truly mind-blowing thing. Just think of what it meant for Jesus. For Jesus, the Father rejoiced over him. You're my son, I'm delighted in you. The Father was committed to always dealing with Jesus with perfect love, always being there, guiding him, helping him. And not only that, but Jesus was the Father's heir. "Ask of me and I will give you the nations as your inheritance." And now Jesus says, "My experience of God's fatherhood will be yours as well, forever." The theologian J.I. Packer, many of us will have heard of, he died this summer, age 93. And he was perhaps best known for his book, Knowing God. It sold over 1.5 million copies. And in that book, he wrote this. It's a famous quote. "You sum up the whole of New Testament teaching in a single phrase if you speak of it as a revelation of the fatherhood of the Holy Creator. If you want to judge how well a person understands Christianity, find out how much he makes of the thought of being God's child and having God as his father. If this is not the thought that prompts and controls his worship and prayers and his whole outlook on life, it means he doesn't understand Christianity very well at all. For everything that Christ taught, everything that makes the New Testament new, is summed up in the knowledge of the fatherhood of God." And not only is Jesus the Son who invites us into his family, this passage also shows us that he is the divine bridegroom who fulfills our longings. Throughout the Bible, God presents himself as a bridegroom, and his people are his bride. I had a little look. You see it in Exodus, in Deuteronomy, in Judges, in Hosea, in Jeremiah, in Ezekiel. It's a big Bible theme. And in this gospel, Jesus is repeatedly presented as the divine bridegroom. Most clearly at the end of chapter 3, verse 29, John the Baptist explicitly declares, "The one who has the bride, Jesus, is the bridegroom." He's here. Jesus is the one the scriptures spoke of. And the reason we had our congregational reading from Song of Songs chapter 3, you might have been scratching your heads as we were reading this love poetry, but it was to show how in our passage the writer John deliberately evokes this same imagery of bride and bridegroom. In Song of Songs there's this beautiful poetic picture of a bride longing for her betrothed. She's longing for her bridegroom, her king. And this woman, we read, didn't we? She wakes early in the morning, longing to be near the one her soul loves, just like Mary in this passage, getting up early. And she's looking for him everywhere in Song of Songs. She even asks the people she passes, "Have you seen him whom my soul loves?" Just like Mary keeps asking in this passage, "Where is he? Where is my Lord?" And then in verse 4 of Song of Songs, chapter 3, the woman at last finds her beloved. And it's a beautiful moment because she holds him and she will not let him go. Just a bit like how Mary clings to Jesus in our passage. Because like the bride in the song, Mary has now found her king. She's found the Lord Jesus. Such a beautiful picture for us. Sometimes we approach these chapters about Jesus' resurrection as though they're just a bunch of witness reports, CCTV footage and forensic evidence from which we can gather and put together and construct a place, a kind of watertight case for the fact of Jesus' resurrection. And of course, this chapter is not less than that. It's full of very compelling evidence. But this passage with Mary shows us that it's a lot more than that. Through Mary's experience here, we see that grasping Jesus' resurrection is not just about this journey from confusion to clarity or a journey from despair to hope. Mary shows us here that understanding Jesus' resurrection also takes us on that journey from longing to fulfillment. That's why Mary's experience is shown to deliberately echo the bride's experience. Jesus once said to a woman by a well, this was back in chapter 4, there was this woman who was looking for satisfaction in all the wrong places, in just a string of romantic attachments. And Jesus says to her, "Look, you are trying to quench your thirst in all the wrong places. Come to me and I will quench your thirst forever," Jesus says. "I'm the divine husband. I alone can provide, I can protect, I can fulfill your deepest longings." And that's the picture Jesus is revealing of himself here in chapter 20 as well. He's the divine husband. And through these two images in this section, Jesus is the son inviting us into his family. He's the bridegroom. He's come to fulfill our longings. We get just a glimpse, don't we? A beautiful glimpse of the relationship that Jesus has come to welcome us into. This is what is on offer to the world. And yet, fascinatingly, unlike the poem in Song of Songs, here in chapter 20 of John, Jesus tells Mary there is a not yet in her experience here as well. Let me read verse 17 again. "Do not cling to me," Jesus says, "for I have not yet ascended to the Father." Yes, this is a time for joy, Mary, but you need to know this is not the final joy. For that, we're actually going to have to wait until the end of John's sequel, Revelation, which ends with the final wedding banquet in the new creation. That's when we'll experience the fullness of what we're longing for. But for now, Mary, there is a job to do. And very briefly, that leads us on to our final point we're going to think about. So let's not keep this news to ourselves. You see, Mary is so pleased in this moment to be with her Lord at last. But Jesus cuts it short and he commissions her for a new task, for passing on the baton, passing on what it is she's received. Look again, Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and say to them that I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Yes, Mary, there is a time for embrace. That time will one day come. But in the meantime, Mary, there are a lot of others who need to hear what you have just discovered. One of my favourite films, actually since I was a teenager, has been Room with a View. It's a bit soppy. It's the adaptation of Ian Forster's novel. I recently made the kids sit through it. I think it was a little bit early for them to fully appreciate it, but there we are. And the film, as a bit of a plot spoiler, you've had decades to watch it. It's about Lucy Honeychurch, played by Helena Bonham Carter. And it's about her slow realization that actually she's in love with George Emerson. And there's a moment when she suddenly realizes what we as readers or as viewers already know. And she breaks off her engagement with Cecil and she tells George's father that she's discovered she's in love with George, but that George's father is not to mention it. And there's this beautiful moment where Mr. Emerson says, "There's a time for keeping quiet and there's a time for speaking out, Lucy. There's a time for keeping quiet and it is not now." And that is the tone of these verses here in John 20. If Mary has understood anything that Jesus has said, she will understand there is a time for keeping quiet and there is a time for speaking out. And now is not the time, Mary, to keep this to yourself. And so she gets it. And verse 18, off she goes. Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord," and that he had said these things to her. The great end to this section. We began with the question, can we know for sure? And the good news is we really can. It's wonderful news. Jesus reveals himself to those who seek him. And he welcomes us into a new relationship with God, where God is our Father, where Jesus is our bridegroom. And like Mary, one of the marks that we have grasped this is that we long for others to discover what we've experienced. And my prayer is that the Lord might grow that instinct, that desire in us as a fellowship to be open-handed like Mary was with what she had received. I'm going to finish there and leave a moment's quiet for us, just to reflect on what the Lord's saying to us in these verses. And then we'll have our prayers in a moment. But let's have a time of quiet first.